Hello and welcome to another episode of the 1020 podcast. Today I have the great pleasure to talk to Jeff Snyder of Eurodollar University. Jeff is a macroeconomic analyst and he publishes regularly on his own YouTube channel. He's very active on Twitter and is working with other economists on regular contributing to the discourse and analysis of what's currently going on in the world of economics. Jeff, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Ralph. Thanks for having me. Really looking forward to it.
It would be great. Could you tell us a little bit of what Eurodollar University is and a little bit of how you came to it and what kind of your profession is at the moment, what you spent most of your time doing?
Well, I've been an investment advisor and I still work in that world. But mostly I've been an independent researcher because from very early on in my career, I took a particular notice in how the way the monetary system behaved, or really how few people understood what was going on. And what really unnerved me and set me off on this path was the fact that most people didn't want to know. They didn't want to know how money worked. They didn't know how, you know, the monetary plumbing works. They didn't want to know about reserve currencies or any of that stuff. It was more of, let's just leave it to Alan Greenspan. He's the maestro. He controls everything with a flick of a switch or something. And so that myth pervaded the financial services industry. And it really was unnerving to me, especially as an analyst early on. When you start taking look at really a deeper look at banks, you know, as an equity analyst, you look at banks and bank stock, you want to know what the banks are up to. So we started to really get involved in what these banks' balance sheets were and started seeing all sorts of weird stuff they don't teach you in school. They don't tell you about on the news or back then, the early days of the internet or on cable TV. And it was sort of, again, unnerving to hear this, just leave it to Greenspan, just leave it to Greenspan, when there's all this other stuff going on. And so over time, obviously, the little hiccup there in 2007, 2008 kind of validated that approach, because as it turned out, all this stuff that's been going on behind the scenes in the shadows was incredibly important, not just in 2007 and 2008, but also for what has happened afterward, which has really left the public in a state of gross confusion, which is understandable, because, again, it's sort of, well, now we have this crisis and there's a bunch of QEs. Maybe QEs fixed it, without ever really considering all the details, the monetary details. So what I do over time, it's been more and more about focused on the research, understanding this euro dollar system, which is really the reserve currency monetary system, and trying to give people a sense, trying to tell people, at least start asking questions, start thinking about the monetary details, because they really do matter. And Eurodollar University is really the platform I've come up with to try to help people understand the not just what's going on in the monetary system, but really the implications and consequences of it. Because whether you realize it or not, the Eurodollar has been there the whole time and it is impacting everything you do.
I mean, this is so interesting. It kind of started this year a little bit. It actually started because in 2020, we had the pandemic and kind of everybody all of a sudden got super interested in virology and, you know, modeling when it comes to the spread of diseases. Then now we had the invasion of Ukraine by Russia and everybody all of a sudden got interested in international relations. Like, you know, all of a sudden, you know, people talk about John Mersheimer and realist theory and this kind of thing. And now that it looks like we might be tipping into a recession, everybody is very interested in economics. So it's a resurgence of interest in these areas. And when I kind of scroll a little bit, you know, through Twitter, and, you know, I have a subscription to Bloomberg, so also something I didn't have a year ago. So there's also a kind of financial commitment to the information. And sometimes it's difficult to say whether it's doom scrolling, right? You know, that the sky is falling, or whether things maybe are not as bad as some would say. So in your assessment, and of course, to be very clear, and I'm not asking for investment advice, but your gut feeling, let's say, kind of, or as a rule of thumb, what do you think we're heading in 2023, right? Some say that, you know, it's probably not going to be so bad for the United States. Europe is in a much worse situation. China is kind of hard to tell, right? Some say that Xi has now kind of hardened his grip, but in fact, the economy is sitting on a huge real estate bubble that can burst. So if you would kind of take us a little bit on a tour around the world, kind of at the hotspots that you see as the most important one, right? There's, of course, also the Middle East. We know that OPEC Plus has or at least is attempting to cut oil production. So there's so much going on. So if you would kind of have a ranking of what's going on in your mind, what you have a focus on, what would it be and what would be your assessment of these developments in these areas?
Well, if we look at the financial market indications, because, you know, as you know, starting from the perspective of the Eurodollar system, which is something we cannot observe directly because there's no information, there's no regulation, there's no monitoring, we're sort of left trying to tease or at least to reverse engineer what must be happening in the monetary system by what we see of market behavior. So market behavior, yield curve, money curves, things like that are exceptionally important, especially since the participants in these markets are the money system itself. So if we, even if we can't directly assess what's going on in the Eurodollar system does give us a lot of signals, a lot of information, a lot of very useful information about what it thinks about the state of the world, the state of the monetary system, and all these other factors. And as you and I were talking before the show started, there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on, beginning with the U.S. Treasury yield curve, which is something I think most people are aware of. You've heard about it. Usually you hear about it when it inverts, and that means recession. It means a lot more than that, but yeah. As a rule of thumb, you don't want to see a curve inverted. You want to see it upward sloping because upward sloping means optimism. That's positive rates of growth and inflation, all those kinds of things. Whereas an inverted curve, quite literally, if you take it literally, means that rates are going lower from wherever they are today, which is confirmed by and corroborated by any number of financial indications from Eurodollar futures to interest rate swaps, to even the behavior of the U.S. dollar exchange value. All of these things tell us that the market is preparing for something that's not good. And if we really distill, say, for example, the Eurodollar futures curve, which is nearly 200 basis points inverted from top to bottom, which is unprecedented. When we look at that level of inversion, what it's saying, again, if we take it literally, it's telling us that the market is preparing for interest rates to go down in the near term future. So the Fed, and specifically the Federal Reserve, along with the ECB to a certain extent, they think that inflation is the greatest risk. Therefore, they want to continue hiking rates, although they've kind of softened their stance recently. And the market is saying, no, something is going to happen that takes the Federal Reserve's focus off of inflation and puts it onto something else that is very likely lead to an aggressive series of rate cuts. Now, it's up to us to fill in the blanks about what that is, but the market, whether it's the yield curve or Eurodollar futures or all these other things, they're telling us the probabilities are exceptionally high that something happens or a series of somethings happen that either brings the CPI in the U.S. down on its own and keeps it there, or takes the Fed's focus off the CPI and puts it onto something else. And as you're saying, Ralph, there's no shortage of indications. That could be something major happening in geopolitics, the spillover from the Russia-Ukraine conflict. That certainly could happen. Other geopolitics, China-Taiwan, and there's a lot of nervousness about that. But there's also specific macro factors, as you said, recession in Europe, like the United States, as well as continued retrenchment in the Chinese economy, all of those things happening at once, that wouldn't be very good. That would likely produce the circumstances that gets the Fed into rate cuts, as well as the ECB. You look at the German curve. The German curve is inverted, too. Or it could be something in the monetary system itself. If we have something along the lines of a deflationary breakout, worse than we saw at the end of September, that might do the trick too. And as history shows, you usually have a deflationary breakout at the same time as you have bad macroeconomic conditions anyway. So likely it's a combination of all of these things where, you know, China goes even worse, the U.S. goes into recession, Europe goes into recession. There's really no good place around the globe where you can say this is a bright spot. Then you have the monetary system starting to break down even more. That would certainly get us into a situation where the Fed, the ECB, and everybody else is, forget the hawkishness, forget inflation, we're going to start cutting rates.
So would it be fair to say that markets don't really buy the signals coming from central banks? Right? That they announce they're going to continue to hike rates. They will increase interest rates, kind of trying to suck money out of the market and thereby fight inflation. And markets say, no, something's going to break over the course of the next 10, 12, or even shorter month that will force you to lower interest rates. So is the outlook of the markets then, would it be fair to say that they look at the economic and political outlook globally more pessimistically than the Federal Reserve for the ECB? Or do you think that they just say the Federal Reserve and the ECB are so politically influenced despite their nominal independence that if the recession comes, the political pressure will build to such a degree that they either have to lower the rate hikes or even stop them and start cutting rates again?
Yeah, that's the market is discounting information. That's a lot of it, too, because I think there's a lot of politics involved in the rate hikes to begin with. Certainly in the United States. Yes, nominally, these central banks are independent, but we all know it's a little more gray than black and white there. So, yes, the markets are discounting the commitment to the rate hikes as well as the any political pressures that might arise. If, for example, the U.S. not only gets in recession, but it turns pretty nasty relatively quickly, there's going to be enormous political pressure to reverse everything. But this is nothing new, Ralph. The markets bet against the central banks all the time. Every time we go through these cycles and you see these yield curve inversions, that's really the market saying, we disagree with the central bank. We went through this just a couple years ago in 2018. While the Federal Reserve was hawkish, aggressive, inflation in 2018, the Eurodollar futures curve inverted just a little touch in June of 2018, which was the market beginning to hedge against the sort of circumstances and condition we're talking about now that would lead the Fed not to hike rates in 2019, but cut them. And guess what happened? The Fed stopped hiking rates, involuntarily stopped hiking rates and ended up cutting them in 2019. So the markets were able to discount fundamental money as well as macro information and do so in a very helpful way if you pay attention to these curves that over time told you what was going to happen. Now, it started small in Eurodollar futures in 2018. Then you got Chinese doing stuff in late 2018. You got heavier inversions. You got the WTI oil curve into contango and on and on and on and on. You could see it building and building and building. And so by the time we got to 2019, the Fed pausing and then cutting rates was no surprise whatsoever. In fact, the markets were saying There's never a certainty. There's never 100% in the dynamic world we live in. But as near as certain as possible in the markets, these curves were telling us what was going to happen in 2019. And so here we are in 2022, and all of those same things are happening right now. We've got China RRR. We've got WTIs flipping into contango. We've got massive inversion in treasuries and even more massive in Eurodollar futures. And so it's really the same setup where the Fed is saying we're going to continue hiking rates, but now they're saying maybe we're not going to continue hiking rates because the market has already discounted the fundamental properties of the money and macro conditions of this year and says the probability of rate hikes is very small. In the short run, yeah, there could be another rate hike, maybe two. But after that, relatively soon after that, it's something happens here.
You mentioned in one of your recent tweets and contributions, especially the yield inversion in Germany as something quite unseen and remarkable. So if I might split this question in two parts, the first one, if you would try to explain it to a five-year-old, if one would ever be in such a situation, what is a yield inversion? To grasp it for people who are not that well versed in this. And I have to admit, I had to do a lot of research, I think, to understand this what comes so natural to experts like yourself. And the second question would be, what does it mean for Germany? And why were you, correct me if I'm using too dramatic a term, that you were quite shocked what you saw developing in Germany?
If there's a five-year-old I want to explain this to, I want to meet that five-year-old because they're already way ahead of the game here. A five-year-old that's interested in yield curve inversion, that person needs to be nominated for president right now. Yields, any kind of money curve or yield curve should be upward sloping because what is a longer-term bond yield is, as Irving Fisher showed over a century ago, it's nominal growth and inflation expectations. So if we're relatively optimistic, we expect nominal growth to continue to rise into the future. So we'd expect short-term rates to be relatively low and stable, and then interest rates to go up from there. Not a whole lot. It's not a steeply sloping curve, but it should be gently upward sloping. If the curve shape is not gently upward sloping, that's telling us that some other factors are mixing up or having an effect on longer run growth and inflation and expectations to the point where a yield curve might flatten out first, and that's already a key warning sign. And then inversion is where you start to see longer-term rates go below their shorter-term counterparts. And usually inversion starts with a little bit way down at the end of the curve. And mechanically, all that is participants in the market who are becoming more and more pessimistic for a variety of reasons, beginning to hedge. They're beginning to say something's going to happen where growth and inflation are going to fall off. So it's going to pay if I buy today a very safe and liquid investment, because at some point that's going to really pay off when interest rates go down. So they're hedging against something that's going to pay off or be rewarded and pay out if interest rates go lower, if nominal growth and inflation actually do fall. So inversion is a set of circumstances, whatever it happens to be, which produces a payout owning safe and liquid instruments. And already you have a clue. If safe and liquid becomes in high demand, what does that say about safety and liquidity? Perceptions are not good for those things. Now, what got my attention with Germany is German curve doesn't invert. You go back to 2008, for example, it inverted only a little tiny bit, and it was only on one day. That was June 9th of 2008. Germany is stable. Germany is boring. Germany is the last place you would expect that kind of hedging, dynamic environment, that kind of excitement, which excitement surrounding some negative implications. So the fact that German curve inverted back in September for the first time, and again, it was between the 10-year Bund and the 30-year, which was already unprecedented. The fact that it even happened in September was already eye-opening, but it has been continuous ever since. So we are unprecedented on top of unprecedented, on top of an inversion that shouldn't even happen. So what is the market telling us about that kind of a situation where we completely upended the German curve? If you look at it today, the whole thing is inverted. So it's really sending these strong signals along. You know, even if we were just looking at the German curve in isolation, that would already be a huge warning. That would be a massive red flag where you'd stop and say, what's going on here? But you put that into the context of everything else, and it goes back to what you were saying, Ralph. It's not one thing or another. It's everything. It's everything that looks to be more and more pessimistic, because we have market, we have participants in all these markets around the world, including Germany, who are hedging and hedging and hedging and hedging. And the other side of this, just real briefly, the other side of these inversions is that there's nobody willing to take the opposite side of that trade. The deeper and deeper we get into inversion, that means there's more and more consensus that this something the market is hedging against, or this series of somethings, is more and more likely to happen, because there's fewer people willing to bet against it.
So it's a little bit like in a John Wayne movie, or you know, like in those horror movies where you know where they go down into the dark basement, and you don't really know what's in there, but you kind of know it's going to be something really, really bad. And it seems a little bit like this as well. So we look at what you just described with yield inversion. Like, we don't really know what the market, since of course it's many actors acting, we don't really know what causes their pessimism, but obviously they are pessimistic. And that strikes me as very interesting to contrast, because this is why I find your work so enlightening and so interesting. So you have the politicians, right, and the press releases, and saying, oh no, 2023 doesn't look so bad, and the energy crisis will be over with April, and just as we did in the past, we're gonna easily kind of outgrow then all the debt we're gonna go into, and sure, it's gonna be 5% of GDP to support energy costs of the population, but it's all not gonna be a problem. And now I hear what you are saying, and again, correct me if I'm misinterpreting this, but you're basically saying, that all sounds nice, but the market says, we don't believe you, or we don't see it like that. We think that something is actually, in whatever way, shape, or form, is going to break. And could that be? Because I think that's such a difficult question. So I don't want to put you on the spot, but will these things always then tend to be kind of spurs of the moment, or kind of, you know, stay around for maybe a couple of months, and then over time everything will return to kind of quote unquote the more healthy conditions?
Yet when you look at these kind of indications, first you got to start, you got to realize what they're saying. These are probabilities. We're always dealing in probabilities. We're never dealing in certainties, never black and white. And there's always, you know, dynamic. We live in a dynamic world, so things are always changing, including time components. But by and large, these markets are saying, as you said, Ralph, the probability of the Goldilocks scenario is this. It's exceptionally small. The probability of something happening, and really what the markets are positioned for is something small happens that leads to something a little bit bigger, that leads to something a little bigger, that leads to something a little bit bigger. And next thing you know, things get out of control. That's really the probability here. When you get into this type of situation, what the markets are saying is that it doesn't take much more than a little spark to set off what might become a big conflagration. That's what these inverted curves are really hedged for, is that out of the blue little thing that you, that doesn't seem like to be anything, that leads into a cascading effect. Because the situation right now is exceptionally fragile. Now, what does that mean on the other side of things? I mean, it could be that we have a really nasty recession that is very heavy, very sharp, but also short-lived. That's possible. But the curve shapes don't necessarily imply right now that that's the case. It's more along the lines of something happens, then something else happens, and before you know it, we're at the end of 2023, and it's been a really bad year, and we're not really certain about what 2024 looks like either. So probabilities are, right now, in the short run, a couple more rate hikes, perhaps, maybe one. But then when you get further into the near-term future, probabilities flip in the opposite direction. And the further out in time you go, the greater the probability of the negative pessimistic scenario. So the timing is up in the air, as well as any kind of duration. But right now, the base case in the marketplace is that whatever happens is not going to be a short-run thing.
Is it, there is this, I know this has been overused, but there's this famous quote from Ernest Hemingway's "The Sun Also Rises," right? But this one character is asked, "How did you fall into bankruptcy?" And I think the answer of that individual is first gradually and then suddenly. Do you think this is something we're also increasingly at? And what's going on in Europe? I mean, I know this is, I know it's a little bit of tea leaves reading, but. Do you think it is, or there is at least a risk that simply the economic moment of Europe comes to an end? I mean, Germany might in particular, but generally also in the Eurozone, with maybe some exceptions, Norway and Switzerland, and maybe some other of the Nordic countries, but that simply overall, due to monetary but also other macroeconomic factors, that Europe is not as competitive as it was in the past, and that they continue to spend money where the market no longer feels that they have any idea how they're going to pay it back in the future, which means that at some point they're going to look at them and say, we can only, you know, maintain low interest rates for German debt or Italian debt or whatever it is, as long as there are enough credible players that are willing to pay all of this back, or potentially at least. And this has been for a long time Germany. And as you just described so interestingly, well, it looks like that the outlook for Germany, at least from the perspective of the markets, is not very good. Do you think that this could become a kind of a domino effect and throughout the entire, at least the Eurozone, when kind of the on paper strongest economy is gradually, but at some point, maybe suddenly, losing the confidence of the markets?
Yeah, it's a couple of things. I think we're in that gradual phase already. We have been for the last 6 months or so. Ever since March, ever since the big spike in oil, everything has started to go wrong. That's really when, the inversion showed up in the U.S. dollar part of the system. We saw them get much heavier in March, and then really in June when everything really hit. And then we saw the German inversion in September. So the gradual has already been happening. We're kind of sliding slowly toward what looks to be an edge. And underneath all that, you're right, there are these structural European problems that have never gone away. You know, Mario Draghi had his famous promise back in July of 2012, where he did everything he said to save the European Union as well as the euro there by the European Union. That didn't really work out so well. He sort of kicked the can down the road, and here we are again. And I'll even go one further. I think there are structural issues that actually threaten the European monetary system. Not target two or cash flows, but collateral. You have, as you're saying, Ralph, you've got Italian debt. Because the Germans don't borrow, there's not a lot of German debt out there. So there's a massive shortage of good quality collateral, which Germany's the best in Europe. which has left collateralized transactions, you know, repo derivatives, to be collateralized on Italian debt. Because the Italians borrow a lot. There's lots of BTPs out there, which means that we have this massive discrepancy that's not just fiscal parameters, but also it becomes a monetary parameter that has had an enormous global impact. As you see spreads between Italian and German bonds diverge, decompress substantially, that creates a monetary issue, not just for Europe, but for the rest of the world, because you end up with a collateral shortfall. And at some point, if the macro conditions match the monetary conditions, do the Germans or the Europeans in general say we can't have a system that is dependent upon Italian debt, because the Italian debt is always suspect at these particular moments in time? So there is a very deep fundamental monetary rupture within the Eurozone itself. And it extends to other areas too, but that's a primary one that also has a massive spillover around the rest of the world. You see collateral shortages in US dollar collateral whenever Italian spreads go above their German counterparts. So this is not just an issue for Italy. It's not just an issue for Germany. It's not just an issue for Europe. It's an issue for everybody. And if these scenarios do continue to play out as markets expect, then you get to the conditions where, in political terms, everybody starts pointing the finger at everybody else. And maybe it becomes very easy to say, let's cut this tie here, because we can't have Germany or the US dollar system, everybody attached to Italian debt. Let's see if we can work our way around it. Because let's face it, ever since the first monetary crisis in 2008, we've been moving in further and further in the direction of fragmentation and deglobalization anyway. So if we get into another crisis situation, doesn't that just accelerate all of these darkening trends? I think that's kind of underneath all of these market angst and worries, is that longer term projection, that longer term extrapolation, that we continue to move in the wrong direction, deglobalization, fragmentation too.
I mean, you touched on something that I find extremely interesting. So there has been an argument, at least among political scientists, that with every crisis, European integration is getting stronger, and you know, every crisis draws it closer together. And one thing I enjoy, again, very much in your writing and in your YouTube videos, but I think in economics in general, is it's drier than other social sciences, because it tries to work as much as it can with numbers. And what everyone thinks of numbers, but they're open for interpretation, but at least we start from some common set of facts. And if you look at in the economic and the monetary realm at the euro, the eurozone, and the European Union, and somebody would post that to you and would say, well, if you look at these crises, you know, 2008 up to now, all of this has brought Europe closer together, would you say, well, that might be true politically, or that might be true in the world of political rhetoric, but in an economic economic perspective, would you see that there are more forces pushing it together, or would you potentially see more forces tearing it apart? I mean, again, it's difficult to look into the future, but kind of from what currently, in your opinion, the numbers show, where do you feel that the journey might go?
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a divergence between the official, you know, story about Europe getting closer and stronger and all that stuff. And maybe that's true. Maybe there is pockets of European society that has been drawn together. There's obviously benefits to integration, but we're speaking specifically about money, finance, and economy. I think it's been the opposite direction. It really has, where you have unequal economic circumstances. I mean, the divide between Germany, France, and Italy could not be more stark, not just in monetary terms or fiscal terms, but in terms of economic results. Just look at GDP behavior of Italy versus the other two. It's night and day. And at some point, that becomes an insurmountable problem. Either everybody in, you know, the Netherlands, the northern part of Europe has to pitch in and do something about it, or they have to let go, because it's either redistribute or start over. And the further we go in time, the more crisis we have, the more these chasms widen, the more these gaps widen. And it becomes a bigger and bigger and more intractable problem the more we leave it to, you know, uncertain. Let's leave it to the future. It gets bigger and bigger. It becomes harder and harder to solve. So when you have a country like maybe Greece, that's a small part of the Eurozone, maybe it's not such a big deal. Although, if you remember 2011, it became a big deal. Now we're talking about Italy. Italy is you know, what, 10 times Greece, and it's an even bigger problem that becomes maybe a deal breaker at some point. So, yeah, there are parts of Europe that are definitely more integrated, parts of society that are definitely more integrated. But in terms of just economic, really the monetary system, it's fragmenting even more.
Can I, as one of my concluding questions, allow me to venture a little bit into the area of conspiracy theories. So I came across, it's maybe too hard to call it a conspiracy theory, but I came across an interpretation of the events in China of the last couple of months and weeks, right? You know, the zero COVID policy in China. And one interpretation was that zero COVID in China was not just related to the problem of the pandemic, but almost deliberately in an attempt to play ball with the United States, but I guess partially also Europe, kind of to keep production low, right, to not have the entire Chinese economy, quote unquote, go online again, and thereby reduce a potential pressure due to higher energy prices in Europe and the United States. Now, whether this was on purpose, I think would be the conspiracy part. But apart from this very intriguing interpretation, do you think, is there some truth to the argument that this is like a potential, you know, small snowball or a pebble that could lead to an avalanche if, let's say, China says, okay, we are worried these demonstrations might get out of hand, so therefore we move away from zero COVID, we start to say, you know, it is what it is. People are going to infect each other, but it looks like that lockdowns bothered them more than the actual pandemic. And then as everything comes back online, factories start producing again, that then of course energy prices potentially spike again. And of course with the same or similar effects than we saw in Europe in earlier this year. So do you think there is, I guess the conspiracy part is, I think, more entertaining, but is this like something that runs a little bit under the radar? What's actually going to happen if China should move back, either, you know, because they were forced so by the facts on the ground or because it was a strategy, if they try by all means necessary to get back on a significant growth path related to GDP?
Yeah, I actually do think that zero COVID had almost nothing to do with COVID, but I don't think it has anything to do with some kind of agreement with the United States or Europe. And I think there's a bunch of different threads that all combine here. But the short version is essentially the Chinese economy has been in trouble, not just last year or so, and that the issue is the Chinese economy has been in trouble for over a decade, and that the Communist Party has been moving more back, actually been moving backward in, from our perspective, from their perspective forward, to embrace more of a Maoist approach, because realizing the Deng Xiaoping way of doing Chinese prioritizing economic growth over everything else, that's done, and it's been done for over a decade. And so Xi Jinping has quite intentionally moved further and further, very slowly, very incrementally, in the direction of what he says quality growth or common prosperity, which is really, these are buzzwords for becoming more and more Maoist, where they don't care as much about the economy because there's no reason to. There is no global growth engine anymore for which China is going to take advantage. So what zero COVID is about, in my interpretation, is enforcing this authoritarian impulse upon the economy, or upon the economy, beyond, on the citizenry, to remind them, if you're dissatisfied for any reason, including the lack of economic growth today and tomorrow, this is what we can do to you. We can lock you in your homes for a prolonged period of time and put you under same type of conditions as you see in Hong Kong. I think this is an authoritarian impulse that is proactive for a Chinese economy that doesn't have so much economy. And the Chinese have been moving in this direction for a long time. It's just everybody in the West has fooled themselves about China being the global growth savior. At the 19th Party Congress in 2017, Xi Jinping said, we're no longer prioritizing growth. And look at what happened to China's economy ever since then. Slowly, slowly, slowly falling. They've been pulling back in 2020 and 2021. The Chinese, under common prosperity, said, we're no longer going to prioritize the financial sector because that leads to unequal distribution of economic activity. Again, common prosperity. What have we seen since then? In 2021, Evergrande, real estate problems, everything else. The Chinese don't come running to the rescue of the real estate sector anymore because that's part of the plan here. So zero COVID is really about zero dissent, reminding China that the Communist Party rule is absolute, and that absolutism extends to every facet of the Chinese system, including the economy. So if the economy continues to fall off, as I believe it will, there's really nothing to do about it. And I think that the Chinese are actually preparing for it, which is why, given all the challenges this year, authorities have basically sat on their hands. Because that's part of the plan. They're not ramping up production because there's no demand for it, and they realize it, and there's no purpose. So getting ahead of more serious economic circumstances, why not invoke sort of the same Hong Kong type of behavior and ahead of time as sort of a prophylactic measure?
I mean, do you think that this would mean, kind of, we touched on Europe, we touched on China, and of course the one country we left out, or the one area we left out so far, are the United States. And what surprises me especially about the US is, I think at least since the late 1970s, we are constantly told that somebody will take over the United States, right? Either it was the Soviet Union or Japan, or it will be the when it was born in the 90s, the Eurozone, then it was China. But it seems once again that no matter what we discuss in the realm of economics, the fundamentals still do matter. And when you look at the United States, whether it's the dollar, but even the education system, and there are many problems in the United States. I mean, I think that's common knowledge by now. But still, you know, the elite institutions are still elite institutions for whatever problems there might be in public schools. Innovation seems still to be running hot in the United States. In its eccentric forms, like Elon Musk, right? But there's a lot more going on in the US beyond what catches the headlines. So do you think that ultimately, whatever might happen over the next 2 or 3 years, the United States kind of will maintain their economic dominance or might even get out a little bit stronger of the whole situation simply because they seem safer, right? You know, if you say, if I have money now and I say, okay, things seem to turn into a bad direction. Everything gets less certain. Where can I put my money? Maybe then my return on my investment also is smaller, but at least I know that after 3 years, I still gonna have the same value if I take it out again. And if somebody would ask me, where would you put your money? It always seems, well, wouldn't the United States be the most logical place to put it?
Yeah, in terms of relative importance, yes, the U.S. always seems to come out on top. And a lot of that has to do with the euro dollar system. Therefore, the dollar denominations is not really a privilege. It's at times a burden. But yet there is a sort of, there's sort of a shield there that does take some of the bite and some of the sting out of these periods of deflation, these periods of economic recessions and contractions that do seem to hit everyone else just a little bit harder every time they happen. So, yeah, I expect that the U.S. is going to suffer as much as everybody does, but maybe it comes out the other side just a little bit relatively better off because the amplitudes of every single one of these ups and downs seems to be a little bit less here than everywhere else for a variety of reasons. And, yeah, I mean, I think China's as a growth story that ended 10 years ago, and we're finally starting to come to terms and come to grips with that. So just like Japan was going to overtake the U.S. in the 1990s, the China was going to overtake the U.S. in the 2020s. I don't think that happens either for a variety of reasons, including, you know, what's going on in the economy. I mean, demographics are awful over there as well. And then you've got problems in Europe. We discussed a little bit about that. The fragmentation concerns are even greater there than anybody else. And what it comes down to is the entire world has a lot of problems, but maybe there's one or two fewer in the U.S. than other places. It's the old argument, the old adage of the cleanest dirty shirt. Nobody's clean here, but maybe there's a little bit less soiling on the U.S. shirt than everybody else's. For a variety of reasons, not that there's anything that we're doing here in the U.S. better than anybody else. It may be just random luck, or it may just be it could be any number of things. So, yeah, there is that component to it.
If you allow me one last question, because this was so interesting, and kind of to combine two things that you were talking about. So we touched upon the internal issues of the European economy, and we also touched upon the internal conditions in China. But on the long run, what can that again mean for Europe? If we think in many European nations have China now as their most important trading partner, as their most important market, we have seen now, and I fully share your interpretation of what's going on in China, particularly kind of the political side, the ideological side is now more important than the economic side, and we see now what the regime is willing to do if they think it is in their political / ideological interest. So what happens if that market not just becomes more uncertain, but in the worst case, if, you know, for whatever reason, China just, you know, either, you know, nationalizes foreign factories or foreign, any of these kind of things, isn't that becoming from, let's say, Europe's opportunity increasingly becoming Europe's risk?
Yeah, it becomes what used to be one of the few strengths becomes flipped on its head, and it becomes one of its primary weaknesses. I think, again, who is one of the, you know, as you're pointing out, Ralph, who's one of the, which country is the, one of China's biggest trading partners? Germany. Why is the German curve inverted? It's all of these things are related together. The worse it gets for China, the worse it gets for Germany, right? It's not just energy prices. It's this breakdown in global integration, which for a while created a lot of prosperity around the world. But now that we're moving in the opposite direction, what used to be strengths suddenly become weaknesses. And usually we don't identify those weaknesses. At least political authorities have a lot of trouble identifying weaknesses, where it's much easier to say that guy over there did it. It's not us. It's not anything we did. Let's blame Italy, or we'll blame somebody else. I mean, it's so much easier to do that than actually to fix the problem. So that's why there's, I think, a high degree of fragmentation risk, is because there are so many potential what used to be strengths, especially for Germany, now it's exact opposite. And the more China goes in the same direction, the worse it's going to be for those most exposed to China. But then it cascades to everything else. There is no place to hide here.
So promise, my very last question. If you would have looked into the future, let's say 5 years or 10 years, do you think the trend towards fragmentation, deglobalization will continue? Or, again, very hard to predict the future. Or do you think there might be a turnaround potentially sooner than we think?
I don't know about sooner. I hate to be that pessimistic, and I always have to leave it on the least optimistic. So let me... I think in the short run, in the intermediate term, there's not a lot of good things going on there. I think fragmentation continues. But I am a long run optimist. I believe that we do go through, and you see these periods throughout history. They do happen, and they are prolonged, and they are no fun to go through. And unfortunately, we've been going through one for the last 15 years, but eventually they do come to an end. Eventually we do figure things out, or at least if we don't know what went wrong, we start to figure out a couple things that could possibly go right. And we start to fix problems slowly and slowly. And eventually, things do pick back up again. We go through these globalization cycles fairly regularly, and they're usually tied to monetary conditions too. And once we fix the monetary system, that can unlock a whole lot of global growth potential that has really been pent up for a very long time. So once we get through the worst parts of this stuff, you know, maybe it's another recession, maybe another contraction, hopefully not anything worse than that. Maybe on the other side of it, we start to put some pieces together and start to look at more of a, maybe the latter half of the 2020s look a lot better than the first half.
All right. Jeff Snyder from Eurodollar University, thank you so much for being here. And I hope to have you on again at the latest in November 2023 to kind of recap what was going on that year.
All right, Ralph. Thanks for having me.
Jeff, this was fantastic. Thank you so much.